And I'm delighted to have with me comedian Mark Steele. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure. Now, I guess as a comedian, you get to tour the length and breadth of the country, and you must discover a great deal about the sights, smells and cultures. So apart from the salts, what are you looking forward to most about coming to Epsom?
Well, I think what I'm looking forward to about Epsom is, in some ways, what I'm looking forward to about each one of these shows, which is that because it's Mark Steele's in town is the idea of the show, and it goes along the lines of the radio show of the same name. Mm-hmm. And it's because I'm fascinated, really, with what makes each town distinct, and especially in these days when everything's being made to look identical. And so everywhere, I think, has got places that is just for that place, and I always think that's the most fun bit of any show. And I was in Penzance, for example, and people said, there's a town up the road, St Ives, and that's very posh up there, we don't like it up there. And I said to the audience when I was on stage, so do you think St Ives is posh? And this woman shouted out, yes, it is posh, they've got their own dentist.
Ooh.
Marvellous, that could only happen in that one town. And I think everywhere is like that. So the idea of the show is that it's just for that town, in a sense.
Absolutely.
The show is about the towns of Britain and what makes them unique. And I'm trying to do stuff about Epsom. So, you know, I mean, Epsom should be easy for me. It's not. I'm South London myself. So I know you've got your race course and your salts.
Yes.
I've been reading the history of Epsom and Yule, which I got sent through from a second-hand bookshop, which I wonder when the order for that book came, I wonder if they thought, we've had this on the shelf for 45 years, at last we can get rid of it.
Yes, we have a taker. Fabulous. And I guess Epsom has their own dentist as well, so that's all good.
Yeah, you're posh enough to have your own dentist. So you've probably got two or three.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
A drill.
Sport, exactly. Now, of course, bearing in mind at the time of the day, and it's a family show, but can you cite any times when you've sort of been left, you know, vocal heckles left you sort of like a bit bemused?
That often happens. You know, I remember sort of being at a club once and someone started shouting, sell us your fridge. And I don't know if that's too surreal for this time of the day.
But, never too surreal.
But it's brilliant. When people call things out like that. I mean, with this show, it is a little bit like that because people do feel like shouting out the things that they think are unique to the town, you know. So I was in Exeter last night and people were sort of calling things out of little sort of historical bits and what they don't like. And someone was calling out that they didn't like the rest of Devon. Exeter should be free from the rest of Devon. And I said, what, have you got your own little guerrilla army and that? And you go around in hoods and threatening to become suicide bombers, blowing up tractors. But they were quite up for this.
Ooh.
And I even got a message afterwards to say that I'm in the Exeter Liberation Front. And so it's all a bit surreal. I can't imagine.
No, what have you started, Mark? You've started a radical group of its own.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I did once, when I was in Skipton in Yorkshire, and I noticed there was a town called Keighley up the road. And I said, so is that your rival town then? And it went absolutely chillingly quiet. And this woman went, Keighley is a sink of evil.
Oh, hit a raw nerve there, didn't you?
Well, clearly, yeah.
I guess, you know, by your own admission, you've been on the infamous comedy circuit and you've followed some rather bizarre acts. Can you cite any in particular that you thought, I never want to follow again?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, because I haven't really done the clubs for a long time, but they're tremendous fun. I mean, and there are always acts that are completely mad. There used to be a bloke who used to come on with a block of ice, and then he'd get a welding torch and he'd just melt the ice. And that was his act. He didn't say a word.
No words were needed.
No. And then there was... I remember once being on behind this Geordie escapologist. And this Geordie escapologist. And I was waiting behind the curtain and he was doing his big number where he was trying to get out of a sack. And it was at the Colchester University, it was, as well. And he got these students out of the audience, like they do, to sort of tie him up. And you could hear him from the middle of the sack, make sure the knots all tight, leak. And And then I thought, I mean, this is going on a bit, isn't it? It's just ages and ages. I thought he's stringing this one out. And then I was behind the curtain and I could hear this muffled noise from within the sack going, "Mort, could you come and let me out? I'm stuck."
Oh.
And I had to go on the stage and untie him.
Oh, the illusion shattered.
Yeah.
Wonder how long you've been doing that act for.
I don't know. I quite enjoyed that, though. I mean, you know, if he'd just climbed out of it, I'd probably never have remembered it. Right?
Well, exactly. It's probably done deliberately, wasn't it? It was a cunning ploy. Well, I guess the ice melting one would have gone quite well with your fridge, you know, but your fridge act. But maybe they got you a bit confused with Tony Hawks.
Maybe it was him. Maybe it was. That was instead of your fridge, it was the ice man. I've got a show to do tomorrow night, I've got no ice.
Oh, exactly. You could have come to the rescue on that one. Well, I guess, I mean, you've had such a diverse, you do so many diverse things, and I've got to say, to meet the fabulous Christopher Lee, I'd want to turn to a regular slot on Radio 4, but what was it, how did you come about to meet him on Loose Ends?
Oh, that's digging up some marvellously well-researched bits of obscurity there. Well, I was on Loose Ends, which was still is a programme that goes out on Saturdays on Radio 4, and it was with the dear Ned Shearing, God rest his soul, and I know it was brilliant fun, because I'd go in, and I was a sort of fairly newish comic, really, but Ned liked the thing I did about cricket. Mm-hmm. So he asked me to go on there quite regularly. I was on there every sort of 3 or 4 weeks doing a little piece, little Radio 4 vignette. Mm-hmm. And it's a show that people make sure they go on, even if they're hugely famous, to plug things. Mm-hmm. And so you'd go on, and there'd be the most extraordinary people. I remember sort of Britt Eklund being on there one morning. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the show, we just went in this dirty pub that was around the west. Not a dirty pub, but there's a fairly normal
spit
pub.
Spit and sawdust.
Yeah, and I just sort of walked round there. I walked into the pub with Britt Eklund and sat in the corner of the pub there. And I said, "Do you want a pint, Britt?" And there was couple of people playing darts. It's really, really strange.
That's surreal, isn't it?
Yeah, and Joseph Heller, you know, Catch 22, and be going there around the same pub with him, and sitting in the corner having a pork pie.
Oof.
And probably not a pork pie in his case, was it? But nah. You know, having sort of sausages and things. Yes. And then and Christopher Lee once was on there. Yeah, yeah. I can't pretend to have. I can't pretend to have made a great impact on him. I don't suppose when he looks back on his life that he'll say, "Oh, I must write a chapter about the day I met Mark."
He might write a chapter about, I remember a person that I know that used to work on a fruit and veg store, and he had to ask the infamous question about Dracula, and a bit of a stony response on that one. Don't think he likes to talk about that, so hopefully you didn't bring that one up then. Doesn't like to talk about Dracula. Not very often anyway.
I wonder if you think that ruined my career.
Exactly, yeah.
If I hadn't done that Dracula, I would be remembered instead as playing one of the soldiers in Julius Caesar in Epsom in 1954.
Yeah, exactly. We're back to Epsom, you see. That's where it all happens. It's the it's the pinnacle, really. But and what would you say? You're also a brilliant writer as well. What would you say? The meanderings of a comic mind in confusion. Did you write that book with the public in mind, or was it a kind of cathartic way to clarify your own thoughts?
Blimey, now I feel like I'm on Radio 4.
Oh, do you? Oh,
program.
Good. We've turned the corner.
I suppose writing anything is a little bit like that, isn't it? It's a little bit sort of, I want to clarify my own thoughts. I know every week when I write my column, I sort of think, oh, blimey, I better work out what I think about this issue then. I just write a load of rambling incoherence. I know it does come out as that anyway, but... So I suppose the idea of the book is that I was sort of in my mid-40s, and it just seems, I mean, that seems strange for a start, doesn't it? You won't know, but getting to that age seems very, very peculiar, and I don't like the idea when people say, "Oh, but it's much better to be that age because you've got all the experience." And I think that's daft. I mean, no one who's 19 says, "I wish I was 50," do they?
No. Well, you don't want to be older when you're younger sometimes. Then you want to reverse the process as you get older.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, that's very complimentary, thank you.
It was a little bit about that and about things becoming... I felt more confused about the world than I did when I was 18, really.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know, I hope it was funny. I mean, occasionally with books, people have said to me, oh, yeah, I read your book, and I found it really inspiring. And I think, well, that's no good to me. I'm a comic, and I'm not Martin Luther King.
Oh. As long as you need to be inspired yourself for the next one, I guess, don't you?
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah. But I'm trying to do jokes. No, that's really no good at all if you just sit there and go, well, I thought that through, and that really does make a... But, of course, there are people that just have no sense of humour, and that's how they look at it.
That's true.
That, if you're on one of those posh programmes on Radio 4 being interviewed, that can happen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You tell a joke, and people say, yes. And I can understand that from the comments you made about the two dinosaurs that go into a pub, that you obviously take a great interest in Jurassic matters. It's a joke.
Kind of kills it a bit, doesn't it? I guess as comics, you spend a bit of time confused, would you say? Or do you think it's because you look at the world in a different way?
Yeah, I think we're probably quite neurotic and sick individuals, really, because you partly think, oh, I want to know what's going on, but then everyone's trying to think of the joke. It's a bit grim, really. You know, millions of people marching up and down, risking their lives in Cairo, and you're thinking, I wonder what the joke is.
Yes, exactly. Something about fizzes or something. Yeah, I know. Especially, you've got to look at things, turn them on the head, haven't you? And I mean, when you're writing your books, do you have a sort of audience? Do you have a picture of the audience in your mind, or are they a very different audience to your stand-up audience?
Well, it's in a way, writing a book is the opposite to being a stand-up comic, because a stand-up means going out in front of a whole room full of strangers and talking in front of them for hours. And a book is obviously the most isolated thing you can do, just to sort of completely cut yourself off from the rest of the world. And, you know, even your family, you end up just sort of sitting in a little corner somewhere like an insect.
Being fed meals occasionally.
Like a bug.
Oh.
That's what it feels like writing a book.
Oh, sounds quite like Kafka, doesn't it? Metamorphosis.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I feel a cultural moment coming on.
I'm enjoying this interview. You don't get this when you're on XFM.
Exactly.
Yes,
big shout out.
One in mind of Kafka, Mark.
It's very diverse, this show, I have to tell you. But I mean, I guess the beauty of being a comedian is that you're able to answer all kinds of questions on political action and, put things up for inspection. Do you sort of particularly enjoy those panel shows like Have I Got News For You and QI?
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun going on those sorts of things, and you can be irreverent, and people are sort of looking for what's funny about the situation. I think you have to have an attitude, you know. If you're just cynical, and you just think everything's just rubbish and that's it, I mean, if you do it in a certain way, I suppose. But I think it's best to have an attitude and to have some sort of sense. Well, I do have a genuine thought about this as well, and I think you come across, you know, much better like that. I don't know. Having said that, I don't think you have to be. When I was doing an interview the other day for a student magazine, and the student was very, very serious and very much of an activist, so probably a lovely chap, but he said, do you think that it's, first of all, he said, do you think it's not really possible, is it, to be funny if you're not political? And I thought, well, that's just about, of all the questions you could ask, just about guaranteed to kill any comedy, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It's a bit of a downer.
But of course that's not true, you know. People can be funny for all sorts of reasons.
Oh, yeah. There's been so many political people that turn politics on their head and see the humorous side of it, don't they? Lots of different comedians. So, I mean, you can't get too serious about these things, obviously. You've got to be able to, like I said, if it's just cynical, it's not really, there's no joke, is there? There's no humour.
I mean, I think it is naturally funny in a way, the way that the politicians come out with various bits and pieces and the nonsense they come out with, I think is there is something very funny, for instance, about Nick Clegg and his party signing this pledge, not just saying, oh, we're going to scrap this, but filming themselves signing a pledge to say that they will scrap it, as if they're sort of, it's some old ancient parchment that they've come up with, where they cut their wrists and with blood they do cement this mighty pledge, and then they go, oh no, we're doing the very opposite of what we said in the pledge.
Oh, there's a surprise, huh?
Yeah, I think,
a politics, you know, politician talking double talk.
yeah, but they've surpassed themselves with that, haven't they?
Mm.
I mean, how can you not find that funny?
Exactly.
I mean, that's not to say it's not serious. And speaking as the someone responsible for teenagers, that's going to be bankrupted by that, I have to struggle to find it funny.
Yes, it must be very difficult to actually find the humour sometimes in some of the political stories, especially on a topical weekly show. It's trying to find the humour.
Well, people do though, don't they? I think even if people are in the middle of it, people always laugh about the situation. I can't, you know, there is a sort of attitude now that, oh, that isn't that a subject that's too serious for comedy? And I think, well, no one would say that to a playwright. They would say, is this a subject too serious to write a play about or write a book about?
Yes.
But, you know, write a joke about it. And
exactly, see what happens. That's the thing. It sounds like with that student that you were telling about a moment ago, you start a revolution off when you come in places and you've got a book. Vive la Revolution, haven't you, as well? That's been described as a cross between the history of the French Revolution and a spirited defence of the ideals that inspired it. Were you happy with that quote?
No.
Back to inspiration again.
That's disastrous. I mean, that's disastrous from all ends. Because if people do buy it thinking, right, this is what I need to pass my GCSEs, then I'm sorry, I'm probably going to be responsible for somebody ending up working in Tesco.
Oh.
Well, I do try to be funny with it. It is the story of the French Revolution, which is, I think is a fantastic story about. Well, I suppose a little bit like a sort of deeper version of what's happening in Egypt now. You know, the millions of people who didn't think they had a say in the world suddenly realising, blimey, it's what we do that matters. And so all the human stories are amazing there, and all the sort of characters. I'm having to sort of remember back to it all now. But a character called Robespierre, who was one of the leaders of the French Revolution, and he was known as being a very dour chap, wasn't interested, never had a partner at all, didn't drink, hardly ate. I remember reading a quote by him where he said, "It is often said that I am not capable of enjoying the finer things in life, but this is far from the truth. Just last weekend, I was at the friend of a house who had a great many cakes in his kitchen, and one night I was very nearly tempted to try one."
Oh, it's getting a bit dangerous. They're getting a bit on the edge.
Now, a proper historian, that would just pass them by. They would be thinking, no, but what way were the troops going on the 18th?
Well, exactly. It's the bits we didn't know about him, which makes him interesting, about what was his culinary delights.
Yeah.
And of course, if people do want to...
I do think with history, I mean, I've said before that, you know, when teachers or the government get obsessed with dates, that is really just very upsetting, you know, just as if that's because it's the least interesting thing, if you like.
Yes, in history, yes.
But I would say, I think, the first thing you learn about history when you go to school is the Battle of Hastings. It was when I went there.
Mm-hmm.
When was the Battle of Hastings? What
1066.
Date was the Battle of Hastings? When? And I was thinking, well, I bet even in 1071 people couldn't remember. That they'd be going, oh, it can't be 5 years ago already, can it?
That's the thing.
1067, when Ken got leprosy, it must be.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that's the thing, isn't it? For them, it's a story, isn't it? It's what for us is a story, and it for them, it's just a moment in time, isn't it? Just going back, talking about it normally. Yeah. Now, of course, if people want to buy some of your delectable books, they can go to your... You're very interested in telling people about your independent bookstore that you like to go to.
In Epsom?
No, where your books are. Your independent bookstore that you quite champion, where you can get your books.
Yeah. No, you've lost me there.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah.
You confused me with Christopher Lee.
Have I? Oh, I'll take you back again. Well, you can buy your books from this independent bookstore, which you champion, as well as Amazon,
oh,
which
right,
is good to hear.
Crow.
Yeah,
the
that's the one. Yeah,
Palace.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I love that place. Well, I mean, I'm a big a fan of Crystal Palace and everything within it, really. So, and I suppose because it's those sort of quirky, you know, it's just so upsetting when Tesco's and all these sort of soulless corporate places dominate everything, especially books.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I think it's much better to get it from there. The Bookseller Crow in Gypsy Hill. Now,
yeah.
I thought for a moment you were talking about Epsom. There's a very lovely second-hand cricket bookshop.
Oh, yes.
In Epsom.
Mm-hmm.
Mackenzie's? I think it's called Mackenzie's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're not familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with this, no. I haven't. I shall have to explore.
Been up there. You haven't been up there?
Never been there in my life.
Christopher Martin Jenkins' History of the Cover Drive.
Oh.
An account of the tour between Australia and India in 1961.
Oh, I've missed that one. Oh, fabulous. So that's another bookshop to pop to when you're en route to seeing your show, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's brilliant. It's just like a second-hand bookshop should be. It sort of smells of sort of musty second-hand books and the sort of Debussy playing and all that sort of
Ooh,
thing.
Oh, fabulous. That's what we like. It's nice to hear you're supporting your independent bookstore as well.
I'm
sure you'll have lots of support at when you come to the famous Epsom Playhouse on the 5th of February as well. So.
Okay, no, I'm really looking forward to it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Yeah, it's been lovely. I'll let you return to your writing now.
All right,
take
cheers.
Care. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And that was Mark Steele, comedian who's going to be appearing at the Epsom Playhouse.